secret afternoon. So, last time, I think this mic is not working. That's interesting. Okay, so, Oh, okay. So it's just a mic volume thing. Maybe? Okay, so last time, I am empathetic. Okay, so last time we talked about hazard. So we mentioned sort of the basics of taking a circuit and turning it into a pipeline. But when we did that, we actually ended up with some situations where it didn't actually work correctly. We call these hazards, where if we do the straightforward thing of separating things into stages, putting pipeline registers in between those stages, and so on, we end up with a situation where, because we have dependencies between instructions and because we're reordering the operations of the instructions versus what our one instruction at a time design did, some of those instructions won't work properly without some extra effort. And we focused in particular on data hazards. So this is where we're reading an outdated value from a register because of that reorder, because we changed the order in which instructions read and write things relative to each other. Before, one instruction did all its reads and writes, then the next. After, we could have some instructions do reads, interleave with other instructions writes. So we have this data hazard. And we talked about several solutions to these. And we had our simplest solution, which was stalling. So here we just add knots, so we delay the conflicting instruction until it no longer overlaps with the other instruction. And we can do this in hardware. We'll talk probably mostly next week about sort of what does the logic for that look like. But this is a way we can resolve the hazard. And this works. This will fix our data hazards, and it turns out our other hazards, but it's not great. And the big reason why it's not great is because, well, we often have code which would result in data hazards in a typical pipeline, and that stalling is going to make our program run way, way slower. So we'd like to find a more efficient way, or else our pipeline processor is not actually going to be very useful. And we found one. We observed that often when we had some yet-to-be-written value that we meant to read but didn't, so there's some past instruction which just has later in the pipeline computed a value or is going to compute a value but not written it, often it has computed the value by the time we would want to read it. It just isn't written it back to the register file yet. So we can take that value that's computed already and send it back to where it would be read and use it in place of what we'd read. So we just extend a wire replacing what we'd read from the register file with that value. Now, we don't always want to substitute that value, so we have a mux, and we select between the value from the register file, the one, if we don't have any hazards, and that replacement, and we make sure that we only choose that path in the mux that uses the replacement when the earlier instruction that's in a later pipeline stage is in fact computing the value for the correct register. Okay. I believe that's roughly where we left off last time. Questions about things we covered last time? Okay, so a logistics note, there's no lab next week. So, there's a quiz that's due next week, and it's due on Thursday before a lecture. Question? Is this week's homework still due on Tuesday? The homework from this week has never been due on Tuesday because it's due Wednesday mornings. And I believe it is correctly indicated on the schedule that it is due, it is due the 20th. And it has been that way since the beginning of the semester. Other questions? Okay, so when we left off last time, we mentioned what we called the load use hazard. So the load use hazard, where because for instructions that read a value from memory, that value isn't available until near the end of the memory stage, we can't just use forwarding to resolve that problem. So our solution is to use stalling and forwarding. So if we only use stalling, we'd have to stall until the MRMove queue made it to write back before we could perform our decode. So that would be an extra two cycles. But here, we just stall one cycle, and this is how we resolve that problem. So we combine stalling and forwarding to resolve this, and this is, you know, commonly what we'll do for data hazards. We'll use forwarding alone if we can. Otherwise, we'll do just enough stalling to make the forwarding work. And a proposal that sometimes people come up with is that, wait a moment, you know, we're computing the value in the memory stage here. Why can't I just, you know, send the value there? There, it's available in the same stage. So what's the problem with that? Why isn't that acceptable? Okay, so you're worried that the value that it hasn't had time to stabilize. So which thing on this picture hasn't had time to stabilize?
The coming out of the M stage.
The end of the M stage. So you're worried that it will be too early for the execute stage to use it. So I think you're getting at the right problem, and the problem is that you're worried about like how this fits in with our clock cycle. But the way we consider setting our clock cycle is we make sure we don't have any problems with the value not being stable by looking at our critical path. But the problem here is that this makes the critical path very bad. That previously, our critical path would have been that we have, you know, our ALU here and our data memory. And our previous critical path would have been that would have been one of these stages alone. But now, with this shortcut, our critical path is going to be that we have to read a value from the data memory and then send it back through the adder. So that would be our new critical path. So to make this work, we'd set our cycle time long enough to handle doing the data memory and the adder. And if we're doing that, the question we should ask is, why are the executed memory stages separate in the first place? Right, because the point of having them be separate is that our critical path wouldn't include both of them together. So this is something we'll never do. Questions about this example? And the rule we're following is we always forward to the end of a stage to resolve that. If you look at some other textbooks, they might forward always to the beginning of the stage from the beginning of a stage, and that's also fine. That's not going to substantially increase our critical path, but if we did something like forwarding from the quote-unquote end to the beginning, we increase our critical path a lot. That's not acceptable. Some questions about this issue with the critical paths? And I believe we mentioned last time this issue of forwarding from the end of memory to the end of execute as an option to deal with this data hazard. So our textbook is going to say, oh, you stall the RMove queue. But in fact, real processors say, rather than just having a set of muxes at the end of the decode stage, we'll have a set of muxes at the end of the execute stage too. Just so we can handle this sort of forwarding case. So that's going to make things more complex, and you'll probably be glad not to do that because it's just a lot of cases to deal with in HCL and to make sure they're all right. But in a real processor, you know, this is enough of a performance improvement that we're going to do it. I alluded to our forwarding timings issue. So we're adding muxes, so we are increasing the cycle time, just hopefully not by a significant amount, because they're always just basically one extra mux on the critical path, nothing more. Okay, so we've looked at our five-stage processor, but to think about forwarding and other ways of resolving hazards generally, it's helpful to think about other processors. And I mentioned when I talked about hazards that we had dependencies, where one instruction depends on another. In hazards, dependencies were just property of the two instructions. Doesn't matter what they're running on, but hazards, it matters what they're running on. And a good example of this is if we have different number of stages in our pipelines, we're going to change our hazards. So for example, between the add and the and here, because of our 8, there is a data hazard with our 5-stage pipeline, but not with our 4-stage pipeline, because with our 4-stage pipeline, when the and gets to code, the add is out of the pipeline, but that's not true with the 5-stage pipeline. And you'd have to, in general, figure out whether there's a hazard by looking at what's going to be in what stage at what time, you know, before we do anything like stalling or forwarding. Okay, and speaking of different ways of dividing up our processor, let's get into a bit of an exercise here. So let's say we split our execute stage into 2 stages, and since we're splitting it up into 2 pieces, presumably we need all the values for our ALU operation in the E1 stage near the beginning, and we don't get the results in the E2 stage until near the end. And let's assume that we're doing this, and we're going to do forwarding and stalling, you know, that gives us the best possible result, but doesn't violate that rule of making our critical path really, really long. So we're always still going to be forwarding to the end of a stage only. So given that, here's some instructions, and so figure out, I recommend using paper, talk amongst yourselves, where does forwarding and stalling occur to execute this as efficiently as this processor could, this processor design. And one of the things I do to start with this is I look for the dependency. So, you know, the first one I see is that, oh, we have this add writes into R9, and this value of R9 is read by instruction 2, and also read by instruction 3. And I can keep going, find those dependencies, because we should need to think about each of them and say, do we need to forward here or not? And if we need to forward, how is that going to happen? Okay, who'd like some more time? Besides you two? I think I'll start. Hopefully we'll go slowly enough, because it sounded like you were far enough along. So I've identified my dependencies, which I've drawn on here. So notably, instruction 1 writes to R9, which instruction 2 needs. So let's start by placing instruction 2. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to fetch instruction 2 right away, and then do all its stages. So have after fetch, we'd have a decode and execute 1, execute 2, memory, and write back. If I try to do this, I'll notice, wait a moment, there's a problem. If I look at when my value of R9 is available, it's available at the end of execute 2. That's not going to be early enough for me to get it in time to do the add, because the add needs to be done at the beginning of execute 1. So my solution to that is I'm going to have to stall. So that means that instead of doing this decode, execute, memory, write back I was planning on, I'm going to do some sort of stalling. And what I'll imagine is that during the decode step, we'll advance this add to decode, and we'll detect, wait a moment, I need to get the value of R9. I can't do that, so we're going to repeat decode to stall. So we're going to keep this instruction in decode and delay it once, and that's our stalling. So we could have also hypothetically done this detection in fetch, in which case we repeat fetch. But we'd have to detect it a little earlier. That's usually not how you're going to implement it, but both would work. Either way, we're not going to do the real decode step until cycle 3. And when we do that, we're going to need to forward the value, because even though we've waited long enough for it to be computed, we haven't waited long enough for it to be written to the register file. So we're going to forward it from E2 here. So that's for R9. And then our add instruction is going to have all its values. It's going to have the value of RBX, because it gets it from the register file. So that's no problem. We'll have E1. E2, memory, and write back. Okay, so questions on how I did our instruction 2. Yes?
Did
I sell the fetch or the decode? So I sold the decode in black, because that's typically how we'll implement it, but stalling the fetch is a valid option. The reason you choose one over the other is because if you're making the decision to stall without advancing it to decode, you need to make that decision earlier, and that might not always be easy to do. And in particular, in decode, we're already like computing the registers to read. That's a more natural time to figure out whether we need to stall or not. And we'll discuss this maybe a little more when we talk about implementing stalling and forwarding. Other questions? Yeah?
Sorry, did you forward from E2 to D or no?
Question, did I forward from E2 to D? Yes, that's the...
So you stalled and forwarded?
I stalled and forwarded, yes. If I only stalled, I would need to stall a lot more.
Yeah.
Other questions? Okay,
where does the next cycle start now that we've stalled?
So question is, where does the next instruction, I assume you mean, start? So let's get it on to the next instruction. So we're going to fetch it right away, so assuming that we didn't repeat fetch, the fetch stage is going to be open, we're going to fetch the next instruction. And then we would like to advance that instruction to the decode stage, but we can't have two things in decode. So we're going to have it repeat its fetch stage. So we'll fetch it again, effectively wasting a cycle. So this is still, we still consider this one stall, because the stalls is the number, the stalling instruction is instruction 2. It just delays all the instructions behind it. So this is one stall, but Because if we decide to do it in decode, we're going to just repeat fetch for the other instruction. If we decided to do it in fetch, we wouldn't fetch the next instruction in the first place. And after that, our natural order would be that we'd then have our decode, our execute one, execute two, memory, and write back. And here we have another dependency, that we need to get the value of our 9, and we'd like to get it, before the execute one stage. And if we look at that, well, it's available before then because it was computed during cycle 3, and we need it at the end of cycle 4, beginning of cycle 5. But we can't get it from the register file because it hasn't been written yet, so we're going to forward it from the end of instruction 1's memory stage to the end of our decode stage. And we also have RAX, but we don't have any information that tells us RAX isn't current in the register file, so we're just going to read that from the register file. So questions on what I did for instruction 3? Yes? The question is, when we're writing assembly, should we take this into account? So this is something that compilers will do when they're targeting, when they have some idea about the sort of processor they target. We're going to talk later in the semester about writing efficient assembly for modern processors. So modern processors use something that is more complicated than a pipeline, which makes the rules you'd follow a bit different. I guess I should say modern desktop, laptop processors. If we're talking about lower power processors, sometimes they will have a pipeline design like this. In which case, yes, this is how you'd optimize assembly for that, which hopefully is something your compiler would be thinking about when it generates assembly. Yes? So why do we stall the why do we do the fetch twice? So we fetched because the other instruction was decoding. So we didn't have any information that a stall would happen. So fetch just moved on and did the normal thing. But once the instruction 2 decided to stall, we weren't going to send it back to fetch. So we kept it into code. But that meant that nothing else can get into decode. So instruction 3 can't move on to decode. So instead, we're just going to keep its values in fetch until decode is ready to take those values. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering, why couldn't we just take the forwarding R9 from the first instruction E2 straight?
Oh, question is, why didn't we forward to the end of fetch? And that's because we don't have the machinery to accept forwarded values there. And the reason why we wouldn't do that is because, well, in our normal design, we haven't computed what registers to read yet. So it wouldn't make sense to add it there. Another reason is that we only need it at the end of the decode stage to handle all the cases that would matter. Because, if it's not ready by the end of the decode stage, it's also wasn't ready by the end of fetch. But not the other way around. Other questions? Okay, so then we get to the RM move queue. And the RM move queue has a dependency on RBX. And we need RBX for the execute one stage because it's used to compute an address. We're going to be adding 0 to it. So let's work out what happens with that. So I'm going to write down the stages I normally have. So our fetch stage is in cycle 4. Why in cycle 4? Because if we're keeping instruction 3 back in fetch because it can't move on, that means we're not fetching anything new. So we're not going to fetch our move queue until after instruction 3 moves out of fetch. Then we have its decode, which I want to write in the correct place. Decode, execute one, and execute two, memory, and write back. Okay. And we observe when writing down our dependencies that we have two values we need. We need the value of RBX from instruction 2 and the value of R9 from instruction 3. And if we're implementing forwarding the way our textbook works, we have a problem here with the value of R9. That R9 that we want to use is computed at the end of execute 2. And the way our textbook works, we only forward to the end of decode. But R9, we don't actually do anything in the execute stages on. Nothing whatsoever. We don't even add 0 to it. So we could elect to forward it, you know, something like just before the memory stage. So that would be forwarding it to just before the memory stage would be a way of doing that. This would be assuming we're doing not what we're going to implement in our HCL assignments, but have an additional mux so we can avoid stalling in this case. If we didn't have that, we need to stall until so our decode lines up with the execute2, which would be, you know, something that with this sort of pipeline design we'd really want to avoid because that would come up a lot, probably. Then we have to worry about RBX. So RBX is computed at the end of E2 for instruction 2, which is the end of cycle 5. So it's available when we normally be, you know, reading it from the register file, but we need to forward it because it hasn't been written back yet. So we will take that value and forward it. So that's our two pieces of forwarding. And it, as long as we do that idea of having a second option for forwarding for values that we only need at the memory stage and don't use beforehand, you know, we can do this without stalling. If we didn't do that, we need to stall a cycle. So questions about what I did here? Okay, so, yes.
When would it be ready? So, like, wouldn't it have passed the memory stage?
No. Wouldn't what be ready?
Why wouldn't RBX be ready?
Why wouldn't RBX be ready? I mean, RBX is ready in the sense that it's computed here, but it hasn't been written back yet to the memory, the register file, so we need to do forward. Other questions? Okay, so then we get to our last instruction, this R move Q, and I haven't drawn any arrows to it because there are no dependencies. And you might say, wait a moment, it uses R9. And R9 was just written by instruction 3 and instruction 1. Surely it depends on one of them, but it doesn't because it doesn't read R9, doesn't care what the old value of R9 is. So there's no dependency, there's no reason to worry about forwarding or stalling to get the value of R9, only RCX we have to worry about that for. And there's nothing here that wrote RCX, so we'll just add this instruction just normally. And I guess after I write that, I have a cleaner version of this like so. So, any questions? Yes.
For the last forwarding, we did memory to E2 because we need
question is, for last forwarding, we did memory to E2 because we need it before the memory stage? Yes, and I was assuming that, so there's a question of whether we would forward into the end of execute one. We could also do that. But the observation is that we could implement a forwarding path which resolves this problem, even though our, you know, our textbook's design doesn't do that. Other questions? Yes.
So, have you wasted one cycle or two cycles with your stall?
Question, have we wasted one cycle or two cycles? One cycle. And a way, one way we can count that is that if we look at when writeback's complete, we only have one cycle where we skip a writeback. And it's not really skipped. What's going to happen if we're going to be doing a nops writeback that for a nop we inserted? Yes?
So in a five-stage processor, like we could send the register value from memory to execute. We just don't do that.
This question is, in our five-stage processor, we could send a value from memory to execute as a forwarding path, but our we just don't do that in our textbook's design. Yeah. And that's what this was showing. That we could implement that forwarding path there to make this sort of code work without stalling. Our textbook chooses not to, chooses only to forward at the end of the code, but it's a real option that you could use that will probably make your processor faster for, you know, typical programs. Other questions? Yeah. What happens if we forward something to the E1 stage? So the reason why we could forward to the end of E2 in the first place is because the value wasn't going to be used yet. That if we think of our pipeline, what's happening here is we have our register file, and we have a value we're reading that goes to the data memory, and there's this ALU in the middle. So this is without our pipeline, right? And we added pipelining. We added a pipeline register here and a pipeline register here to separate. This is with just two stages. And with this design, we've added another one in the middle of execute. So here. So that value that's going from register file to data memory is going through those three pipelines. And what I'm saying is that our textbook only adds a mux here, but we could also add a mux here and here to handle some additional cases. And the reason why this works is because that value hasn't actually been used since being read from the register file yet. If it was, then we have a problem. Like, so if we like try to do it to the value being sent to the ALU, that probably would not work very well because we can't change it after we've already computed using it. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so we've looked a bunch at resolving data hazards, but there's some other types of hazards. And the biggest one is control hazards. These are where we can't figure out what the program counter should be. So we remember when we moved the PC update into fetch, we kind of assumed that, oh, we'll just compute the next program counter. But that's not always going to be possible. So one example is with a conditional jump. So here, we have a conditional, a jump of equal. And you might say, oh, a conditional jump, it uses the condition codes. So we just read the condition codes and determine what to do in fetch, right? But we can't do that because the condition codes might not have been set yet. So for example, in this case, you know, the condition codes are going to be set based on the result of subtracting R8 and R9, which by the time we need to have decided what to fetch, hasn't happened yet. We just read the values. At the same time, we haven't actually done the computation, so we can't do it yet. So this is known as a control hazard. We can't even figure out what instruction to run, let alone the values for the instruction, you know, because we're trying to do things in a different order, because we're trying to fetch the instruction after the jump before that subtract completed. So we can resolve these with STOLIT. So my proposal here is that we, you know, we wait 2 second cycles, and then we actually fetch. And usually the way I picture this as far as our pipeline goes is that our if we say what instructions in what stage, that we have our add, our JE, and our I changed this example for no reason. So we have our, in this example, it's add, J, E, and add. And I would say that we do our stages, fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back of add. And we do our stages of the jump, but only when the jump gets to execute do we actually, are we actually able to, after that, figure out what the fetch. Why did we want the jump to get to execute? Because that's when we can safely read the condition codes. Because once the jump gets to execute, the previous instruction finished execute, so the condition codes have been written. So now we can read them. And only after that do we actually figure out what the next instruction to fetch is. So we have 2 cycles of stalling in a minute, meanwhile. So, as a example, sort of this is what I would say, you know, we're doing. So we have our jump going through the stages, and you know, if we're stalling for this, we're going to wait till the jump gets to the execute stage, and at that point, we'll actually figure out what to do. And we have to wait till the jump to get to the execute stage, because we have to get, in this case, the 0 flag. We have to get it to be set, and it's going to be written to a register at the end of the execute stage for the op queue, and we're going to read it, figure out what to do, and compute the next PC, and then in the next cycle, we can use that result to actually do the I remove queue. So the jump is doing the, based on the condition codes, what does this jump actually mean? And then we're fetching the right thing by adding the right value of the PC.
So the nops are written after the jump, not before?
So the question is, the nops are after the jump, not before? So yes. So this is usually how I picture it. So it's kind of, is that we say that we have some nops we add after the jump. As far as implementation, like the jump kind of like is going to be doing something with the fetch stage because it's affecting the next fetch stage. So I understand picturing this as the jump is like kind of in both stages or something. But I think it's easier to reason about the timing if you think of the jump advancing to the execute stage. Other questions? And we have this control hazard for conditional jumps. We have another important control hazard, which is for return. So for return, you might say, let's first remind ourselves what return does. So return reads from the stack a return address and jumps there. And you might say, wait a moment, we have a data memory. Why do we have to wait until the return instruction, like in this diagram, gets to the memory stage to actually read from there? And there's 2 issues with that. So one issue is that we can't, without doing some complicated logic, figure out whether, you know, other instructions are going to be using the data memory yet, and we'd have to do something complicated to like squeeze in the memory read early, which is generally not something we're going to want to do. And also, you know, it might be the case that some instruction is going to write to the memory just before we read it, like in this example. So we have a call followed immediately by a return. If we want to make that work, we better not read until after the call writes, or else we'll read the wrong address. So here we have our return address is stored during time four, and it's loaded during time five, and after it's loaded, we can send it back to our fetch stage to go back to the correct place. Some questions about this stalling scenario for return? Okay, so if we look at our five-stage processor, if we only did stalling, we have up to 3 cycles for our data dependencies. We have 3 extra cycles for return, so each return takes 4 cycles instead of 1. And we have 2 extra cycles for conditional jump, so each conditional jump takes 3 cycles instead of 1. And remember that with our data dependencies, we had a way of dealing with that, a forwarding. And a question we might have, is there going to be something similar for return and conditional jump? And there is. So there's going to be some trick we're going to use that's going to often get rid of this extra penalty. I'm going to talk about this trick, the key idea behind it, by looking at our pipeline from a higher level and thinking about when instructions actually change things. So if we think about, when does our processor state change? Well, we have a bunch of state and pipeline registers, but other than that, we don't actually change things until relatively late in the instructions execution. So we have our fetch and decode where we just change pipeline registers in the PC. In execute, we sometimes edit condition codes. In memory, we sometimes write to memory. And in write back, we change the register and also determine whether to stop the machine or not. And based on this observation, we can observe that if we start running an instruction and it doesn't get beyond decode, we can easily undo that instruction. So to undo an instruction that hasn't made it beyond decode, we just need to forget what's in pipeline registers, and we've gotten rid of the instructions as if it never happened. It didn't affect any of our state. If it got beyond that, undoing the instruction would be annoying. And we can take advantage of this to make a strategy for conditional jumps where we make guesses. We're going to make a guess, and we're going to figure out whether or not our guess is right by the time the instruction gets to the code, so we won't even have to do any hard work to undo that guess. So for what we're going to do for our examples is we're going to make the guess that it jumps to the label that's in the jump instruction. We could have made some other guesses. That's the one we're going to use. That's the one our textbook uses. So in this example, what we could do is rather than stalling, right after the jump not if equal is loaded, we can load the add. And then we can load the rmove q. And the add will have made it to the decode stage, but it hasn't made any permanent changes. And at that point, we can check, did we make a mistake here? Did we run instructions that we really want to undo? And if so, we can undo them by getting rid of them from the pipeline registers, and that's it. And this is going to basically make our jumps 2 cycles faster as long as we guess correctly. And if we don't guess correctly, you might say, well, that seems like an awful lot of extra work. Well, it's not really, though, because the extra work is just, writing something different to the pipeline registers. And before, we were spending that time executing no-ops. So it's pretty minimal extra work. So what this is going to look like is when we speculate correctly, when the jump, in fact, goes to label, we're going to fetch our first 2 instructions and run the decode of the first of them before we figure out if the jump actually goes to label, before we've actually you know, done our, you know, condition code check. I probably should have an example other than R8, because that is a little more predictable. And after that, we just run instructions as normal. So if we always guess correctly, this would be a way simpler implementation of conditional jumps. And we got rid of our stalls and our pipeline bubbles there are replaced with actual work. So we're making our processor more efficient. Of course, the problem is, what if we guess wrong? So what if this is a jump that, you know, is not taken? So in that case, we're going to fetch the add and the RMOQ, because that's what we're going to have time to fetch until we figure out, wait a moment, I made the wrong guess. And at that point, we need to do two things. We need to undo the instructions we started. So we started the RMOVQ and the add instruction. We need to make sure that they don't advance on in the pipeline. So rather than sending the values for add from decode to execute, we're going to send the values for nop. We're going to replace those values with nop values, so we don't do anything more for that instruction. And that's going to get rid of the instruction, which we call squashing it. And we're going to do the same thing for RMOVQ between fetch and decode. Yes?
Does that mean you have to have a mux?
This question, does this mean we have to have a mux for the pipeline registers? Yes. We will talk about that later today. We also need to fetch the correct next instruction. So we need to have some logic, and this is the most complicated part of this, that's going to get the right instruction based on the jump being mispredicted. And note that this is the instruction after the jump not equal, so we have to have saved the address of the alternative somewhere and be able to retrieve it. The solution our textbook suggests is that we pass it down the pipeline so we can get it later. Questions about our scheme for how our conditional jumps work when we speculate right or wrong? Okay, so let's work out how this affects performance. So let's say I'm running programs and, you know, I have some number of conditional jumps that are taken or not taken, and we're guessing they're always taken. And I have some number of returns and some number of other instructions. And we'll assume for this problem that the other instructions don't need any stalls. We can just use forwarding to resolve all the data hazards. So in that case, if we do our prediction, if we do our guessing, then we will take 3 cycles for a non-taken conditional jump, 1 for a normal jump, a taken jump, which hopefully would be our normal jump, but in this case, it only kind of is. 4 cycles for return because of those 3 cycles of stalling, and 1 cycle for everything else. Versus with stalling, the only difference is that for a taken jump, since we're not guessing, we're stalling, we're going to take 3 cycles instead of 1. My question is, let's compute how much faster is our, in terms of cycles per instruction, so that's a measure of throughput, is our processor that does this prediction. Can someone tell me how to get started with this? So what's the sort of computation I want to do to get our cycles per instruction? Yes.
Could you just take the cycles, multiply it by its like percentage, and then just add all of those sums up?
So you're saying take the cycles, so we have like 3 for the first row for our non-takens, multiply by the percentage, and add those all up. So I like that. So we're basically taking a weighted average of the number of cycles, weighted by how often they appear, how often those instructions appear in our program. So our non-taken jumps are 3 plus 1 times 5% plus 4 times 1% plus 1 times 91%. And we do the same thing for the stall column. So those are two processors. So questions about that computation and why it works that way? So when we do that, these are the results I got. So I said 3 times 3%, and 3% is 3 over 100. So we get 1.019 cycles per instruction for our processor with prediction. And when we did stalling only, I got 1.19 cycles per instruction. And this means that it's about 10% faster. And that might be kind of surprising because, you know, our conditional jumps were 8% of our instructions, so not very many of them. And our prediction was barely better than a coin flip. It was 5/8 right, so barely better than a coin flip. But that, you know, provides a very significant improvement. Questions about improvement here. Okay, so we've talked about sort of the impact of stalling and strategies where we do and don't need to stall. And also we talked about that we're going to need to do squashing, where we somehow replace values with another one. And our next topic is going to be, well, how do we actually implement squashing and stalling? And someone said earlier, oh, that means we're going to have muxes on our pipeline registers, and that's true. So I'm going to consider the scenario we had here to start out with. So we had a case where we wanted to keep an instruction in the decode stage. So what that means is we want the pipeline registers that go from fetch to decode to output the same value again. So how does that look? So basically, we're going to want to feed back the output of the register the current value has stored sometimes and sometimes not. And we're going to do this based on whether or not we should stall. So this is a useful mux to have, and you could implement this manually in HTLRS. But HTLRS is going to provide this mux for you for every register bank built in. And the control signal for it is going to be called stall and the name and the uppercase letter part of the register bank name. So another situation that we have to deal with is, I guess this is not a great example, so I'll throw it out. So another situation we might have to deal with is that if we're keeping an instruction in fetch twice, so if during time 0 it's in fetch, and during time 1 it's in fetch, and the instruction before it moves on. So if this is our timeline here, then we want to figure out what to send to the decode stage. And the decode stage should run a no-op. So an example of where we had this situation also would be here. So where we want to, in cycle 3, pass nothing to the decode stage. Right, so that's another decision we need to make. Sometimes we don't want to actually pass on a real instruction, we want to pass on a nap for fetch to decode. And to do that, we'd have a mux like this, where rather than passing like a register index, we pass the values that correspond to a NOOP. So for a register index array, that would be regnon. For an iCode, that would be the iCode of NOOP, and so on. And this is also something that's going to be built in to HCLRS, and this is going to be called bubble and the letter of the register bank. And the idea there is that it creates a pipeline bubble. Remember, we said a bubble in a pipeline was a knob that we inserted because we were doing stalling. So this is tries to make the next stage have a bubble in it in the next cycle. And you might say, wait a moment, but how does it know what the NOOP values are? So the assumption is that you have made the default values of your register bank the ones you went for a NOOP. And that's probably what you need to do anyways, because if you think of our processor starting, you know, in our during cycle 0, what's the memory stage going to do? Hopefully not anything important, because you don't have any instructions there yet. So your default value should be for a NOOP, so that happens for all the stages. So we have these two muxes built in with these two control signals. So stall B keeps the old values for all the registers in the register bank, and bubble B keeps the default values for all of them. And you don't have to use this functionality, but as you probably discovered even in the first pipe lab, there's going to be a bunch of things in these register banks, and writing all the muxes for each one of them would be tedious. So we have this sort of shortcut to save you some time and some, you know, bugs from typos and the like. And the name is stall and bubble. These names are a little unfortunate. We're following the textbook's names. But there's a common misconception that setting the stall signal is all you need to do to stall. It isn't, because you need to send a pipeline bubble somewhere. So let's do a little exercise on how these work. So I have a timeline here. Something in my throat. So during time 0, our input to this value register in the AB register bank is 1, and the output is the default value, B value, of OXFF, and the stall and bubble signals are not set. So I'll start you out with what happens during cycle 1. We look at the value of A value, and normally we copy that to B value. So our question is, are the stall and bubble signals going to mean that we do something different? And they're both 0, so the answer is no. They're both false. You know, we're using the cases of those muxes, which don't change anything. So in this case, my 1 will be the new value during the next cycle. So your exercise is to go through, finish our list here. And notice that I didn't look at the stall and bubble values during cycle 2 to determine, sorry, during cycle 1 to determine what the output was, because B value was determined, B value for cycle 1 was determined during cycle 0. And the same is going to be true in future cycles. Okay, who'd like some more time? Our volunteers. Okay, so I did cycle 0 to 1, so let's look at cycle 1. So during cycle 1, our input to the register is 2, but the stall signal is set. So if we remember, the stall signal says keep the old value, it's this one, so we're going to take the output, which what in this case is our B value, and send it back to the input, overriding the normal input. So in this case, we're not going to copy 2, we're going to keep our value of 1. So then in the next cycle, we look at, okay, our input is 3, our output is 1, stall is not set, and bubble is not set, so we're going to do the normal thing of copying our input of 3 to our output. So during the next cycle, we get output in the right box of 3. So during this cycle, the input's 4, the output's 3, but the bubble signal is set. So we're not going to use either of those values. We're going to instead use the default value, which was declared as OXFF. So we'll end up with OXFF during cycle 4. During cycle 4, we have neither stall or bubble set, so we're going to copy the input, which is 5, to the output. So we'll end up with 5 during cycle 5. And during cycle 5, our input 6 and stall and bubble are on set, so we'll copy our 6 to the output. Then we have our stall signal set. So rather than using the input of 7, we're going to copy the output again. So during cycle 7, we'll have 6 be the output again. And cycle 7 is the same situation. We copy our output again. Our output's still 6 because of the previous stall signal, so we end up with 6 at the end. Some questions about this? I have a clean version here. So next time we'll talk about going from, you know, this sort of abstraction to how do we apply it to scenarios with instructions, where what we'll want to think about is, okay, I know what instructions in fetch and decode and execute in memory and write back during this cycle and what should be in the next cycle. How do I set these stall and bubble signals to make it do what I want? That's where I'll leave off today. See you next week.